if parents want to send their children to a private or parochial school, they may, but let them pay.
Lawmakers get an earful on a bill that would set the stage for vouchers in Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the coach behind the phenomenal success of APU's Olympic cross-country skiers.
You know, it could be raining sideways, we could be hypothermic, hungry, and he would still be jumping out of his socks excited.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Doyon Limited, announcing the 2014 Board of Directors election beginning January 22nd. Early bid proxy submission needed by Friday, February 14th. Information at doyon.com.
The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Officials with Flint Hills Resources Alaska announced today they will halt processing crude oil at the company's North Pole refinery over the next few months. Flint Hills spokesman Jeff Cook says company officials decided to shut down the refinery because of rising operating costs and shrinking profit margins.
It's a combination of things, really. It's the economics of refining, which are really, really tough. Obviously, North Slope crude is higher priced than alternative crudes, and our cost to process are higher.
Cook also cites the legal and financial burdens of defending the company from liability over groundwater contamination caused by an industrial solvent that leaked from the refinery for more than a decade before Flint Hills bought the facility in 2004.
When Williams sold the refinery to Flint Hills in 2004, Williams told Flint Hills that sulfalene in the groundwater was limited to an area on the refinery property. It was not until 2009 that Flint Hills discovered the sulfalene was actually off-site at the time of the sale and had been for years.
The refinery began operation soon after the Trans-Alaska Pipeline started carrying North Slope crude in the summer of 1977. The shutdown will eliminate about 80 jobs in North Pole and will halt the facility's production of gasoline, jet fuel, and other refined products. 35 people will stay on the job until at least November. 10 workers at Flint Hills Anchorage Terminal will keep their jobs for now. Cook says Flint Hills will keep the workers on the payroll until around November. He says some of the workers will also be offered placement at other facilities owned by Flint Hills parent company, Koch Industries. Borough Mayor Luke Hopkins says the refinery shutdown will hurt the area's economy and will probably drive the cost of energy even higher in the interior. The refinery reportedly has an assessed valuation of nearly $150 million, the fourth largest source of property tax revenue in the borough. An Anchorage Superior Court judge has temporarily suspended a regulation that would have restricted women who qualify for Medicaid-funded abortions. The regulation went into effect over the weekend. It requires doctors to fill out a new form certifying the woman seeking a Medicaid-funded abortion is in imminent danger of medical impairment of a major bodily function. The regulation was introduced in August by Department of Health and Social Services Commissioner Bill Struer. Planned Parenthood filed a lawsuit against the state last Wednesday. They object to the state narrowing the definition of when an abortion is medically necessary. Judge John Suttuck can issue a preliminary injunction suspending the regulation for a longer period of time if the court case is not settled quickly. Governor Sean Parnell is calling on the legislature to take on education reform. And as part of that, he wants lawmakers to advance SJR 9. The controversial resolution is the first step in amending the state constitution so public funds can be spent at private schools. Over the last 2 days, more than 100 people weighed in before the legislature on that prospect. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
The Senate Finance Committee took testimony for 4 hours straight on Monday, and most of it sounded like this.
I think diverting public funds to private educational institutions is wrong.
Amending the Constitution in this way is a mistake.
We are standing in opposition against SJR 9.
Close to 100 members of the public offered comment, and all but a dozen spoke against removing the prohibition on state money benefiting private schools. Many of the arguments against SJR 9 focused on school vouchers. While the measure would not create a voucher system, it would enable lawmakers to set one up if they desired. Some testifiers worried that such a system could drain public school funding. Others expressed concern that private schools wouldn't be held to the same standards as public ones and that they would discriminate against students with special needs. Brian Schilling of Eagle River told the story of his adolescent daughter, who has special needs. His family spent $50,000 on private schooling for her, but she continued to be years behind in her learning and was at risk of being expelled. Schilling says they ended up switching into the public school system, and her progress has been noticeable.
Private schools do not have to take all kids, and they definitely don't want my kid, and they don't want kids like her.
The people who testified in opposition to SJR 9 were spread across the state. Some self-identified as politically conservative, most said they were parents, and many said they were educators. During the first portion of the meeting, Senator Pete Kelly, a Fairbanks Republican, asked each person whether they belong to the National Education Association, the union that represents teachers. He stopped after 45 minutes, saying he was doing that to get a sense of which constituencies dislike the measure.
Mr. Chairman, I won't be asking that anymore. I just want to make a point that whether people are a member of the NEA or not does not make their testimony any less valid or their testimony any less sincere. I just want to get a sense of where people are coming from.
Yeah.
And I think I've got a pretty good idea here.
While the question stopped, testifiers spent the rest of the meeting declaring their NEA membership or lack thereof, like in Terry Gottstein's case.
I am not now, nor have I ever been a member of the NEA. I am, however, a member of AAA.
The public testimony offered the next morning was more supportive of SJR 9. By that point, at least one conservative advocacy group had blasted an action alert urging members to testify. Just over half of the two dozen comments were in favor of the resolution. Senator Mike Dunleavy, a MATSU Republican who's leading the charge on SJR 9, told reporters on Tuesday that he thinks members of the public education community simply managed to rally their base faster, and that polling data shows the majority of Alaskans support his position.
I think the folks that oppose SJR 9 got a number of their people out.
In defense of his resolution, Dunleavy has also said that concerns that SJR 9 would negatively affect public schools are overblown. He wants people to separate his resolution from the idea of vouchers.
There's no case that we could find in which it spun out of control, in which it emptied the coffers, in which it bankrupt school districts. We can't find any situations like that, although we've heard about this through those that don't necessarily support this concept, that this could be the case. We can't find data that supports that.
The measure needs the approval of two-thirds of the legislature to advance. If successful, the constitutional question would then be put on the ballot for voters to decide. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
A measure that would regulate marijuana like alcohol has enough signatures to appear on the ballot. Today, the Alaska Division of Elections verified that more than 31,000 of the signatures submitted come from registered voters. The lieutenant governor is expected to certify the initiative this month. If the marijuana initiative is successful, Alaska will be among the first states in the country to effectively legalize the drug. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the restrictive king salmon resolution that was almost adopted at the Fish Board meeting.
I believe we're now concerned about opportunity, in my opinion, more than the fish.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. And by
Rural Energy Enterprises, supplying Alaska dealers with fuel-efficient Toyo stoves and Oil Miser heaters for more than 26 years. Local dealers can be found at rural-energy.com.
After nearly 2 weeks, the Alaska Department of Transportation says the Richardson Highway in the Keystone Canyon area could reopen as soon as tomorrow. KCHU's Tony Gorman has more.
Crews took advantage of favorable conditions and made significant progress in cleaning up the Keystone Canyon area. Officials are confident that crews will have the area cleared by 3 p.m. Wednesday. DOT spokesperson Jeremy Woodrow says there may be some cautions once it reopens.
There may be some flaggers for the initial opening, just in case that there is a little bit extra debris on the side of the roads. But they're working on trying to clear as much of that debris and put it off the side of the road so that it isn't an issue for traffic.
DOT says the roadway is in good condition and can support both passenger and commercial vehicles. The cleanup of the Keystone Canyon area of the Richardson Highway comes following nearly 2 weeks after being underwater due to an avalanche. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
The State Board of Fisheries continued its Upper Cook Inlet meeting today. Much of the day was devoted to Kenai River king salmon issues. But as KDLL's Shaylin Cochran reports, the board began the day by taking a step back.
By day's end Monday, the board had taken a significant step toward king salmon conservation. It adopted a proposal that established an optimal escapement goal of between 16,500 and 30,000 king salmon for the Kenai River. That move was significant because raising the escapement goal also raises the possibility that there will be even less fishing for kings, and that's for both commercial set netters and the sport fishing community. The Department of Fish and Game is predicting a king run not much bigger than that this year, and 1,500 fish might not sound like much, but with returns at record low levels, every king counts for that much more. Clam Gulch set netter Sam Tika told the board that while kings are important, they're not everything.
As a commercial set net fisherman, I understand how important the Chinook king salmon is to the economy surrounding the Kenai Peninsula. Do I, however, believe this one fish species is worth sacrificing a whole fishery to protect? No. I believe we need to take proper steps to try and find out how to properly harvest the abundance of sockeye red salmon flooding the Cook Inlet on a yearly basis.
But by Tuesday morning, the board had changed its mind. After meeting with commercial fishermen following Monday's decision, the board decided that a different statistical model might be better to base this sort of decision on. And that prompted board member Tom Kluberton to bring the measure up for reconsideration.
What was brought to my attention last night, they have adjusted their methodologies to incorporate enough of a safety factor in the management of the stock that I feel the board is not in a position at this point to have to add that extra bit.
Statistically speaking, that extra bit isn't really significant. It was simply a function of going with a different kind of escapement goal. Changing those goals can be done for a number of reasons, but the department's chief fisheries scientist, Bob Clark, says the reasons for this change didn't quite pass muster.
There are times when people will propose different escapement goals where there is a biological problem in terms of producing long-term yields. That 16.5 wasn't one of those.
Board Chairman Carl Johnstone did not vote to keep the escapement goal the same. He says by maintaining the status quo, the board is not doing what it's charged to do, protect those king salmon stocks.
And I still believe that it was my job to protect the fish, and that protecting the fish trumped opportunity. I believe now that we're looking at it, we're now concerned about opportunity, in my opinion, more than the fish.
The Kenai River Sport Fishing Association brought up the original proposal. It and other like-minded groups have been saying they'd gladly give up fishing for king salmon if the commercial fishing that also harvests some kings is slowed down in kind. That parity and restrictions is what this debate is all about. Kevin Delaney is a retired fish and game biologist and now works as a consultant for the Sport Fishing Association. He's been to a lot of these meetings over the years, and he says it's not totally unheard of for the board to change its mind. But
it's somewhat uncommon to have a reconsideration, use that strategy, but it's very common for the board to adopt in concept a series of 6 or 8 or 10 proposals and then go back and look at them from the 10,000 foot level and see if they intermesh in a way that meets the objective of high levels of sustained yield and high economic values.
The economic value of all the sockeye that commercial fishermen might not have had a chance to catch under a new escapement goal was conservatively estimated at about $2.5 million. Now, all of that debate was just about the late-run Kenai River king salmon. In our next story, we'll learn about the proposals that are being heard to help the early run, which is in even worse shape. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
The University of Alaska Anchorage's new athletic director, Keith Hackett, wrapped up his first 100 days on the job last month. He's finished his first Great Alaska Shootout and watched cross-country running and volleyball cap off a successful seasons. But he says there is still work to be done. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
When Keith Hackett was hired, UAA was in the midst of recovering from the controversial firing of former athletic director Steve Cobb and hockey coach Dave Shayak. During the hiring process, Hackett knew of the lingering fractures caused by those events, but it didn't deter him.
I accepted it knowing that and knew that what I had to do was be ready for anything.
So far, Hackett has spent a lot of time building new relationships and trying to rebuild old ones with community members and partners that were damaged or had fallen by the wayside over the past several years.
I'm a firm believer in no one of us is smarter than all of us. And I think it's just so critically important for me in my role to bring people together.
Among those relationships Hackett is setting out to repair is with Anchorage's hockey community. Mark Filipenko is the president of the UAA Hockey Alumni Association. He says he likes what he's seen from Hackett so far.
Asked a lot of questions. I think he's really trying to figure out, you know, what the next steps are and the best steps to improve the program. And you know, he has some really good ideas himself coming from a successful program. So it's been a real nice pleasure working with him.
There have been a lot of questions for Hackett to answer as he's spoken with members of the community. But having only been in Anchorage and at the university for a few months, he says some are difficult to answer.
Most of the questions have been, well, what are you going to do with this? What are you going to do with hockey? How come there's no ice at the arena? I don't have some of those answers. I just know that I'm going to do the very best I can every day to help our student athletes to be successful and in turn help our coaches to be successful, help our university to be successful.
But he says even if he doesn't have all the answers yet, those conversations have helped him identify some of the issues the athletics department is facing. Hackett has also been eyeing other issues that need to be dealt with, most notably revenue.
My plan with regard to the financial equation has everything to do with generating revenue, and that's through ticket sales, concessions, rentals, all those kind of things, because we have to take on a larger part of that burden.
That issue is growing especially prevalent as the department prepares to move over to the new Alaska Airlines Center, which will cost an estimated $2.7 million per year to maintain. Hackett says the Sports Center will open up opportunities for new revenue streams that are currently unavailable.
We have to do some things to fully utilize or maximize the use of that building. And part of that is going to be we want more people to come to games. So we have to go out and sell tickets. We have to find a way to get people to come.
Ticket sellers will have a big job once they start work next summer, as the Alaska Airlines Center holds about 4,000 more people than the Wells Fargo Sports Complex. Hackett is currently working on a report outlining his first 100 days on the job and identifying issues the department needs to address. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. It's time for the Healthy Futures Challenge. Pull out the jump ropes or go sledding with the family and get out and play. Get moving with activities the whole family enjoys. Find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. Healthy kids are happy kids. Inspire your kids to get out and play every day. For more ways to get active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Most Alaskans know who Olympic skier Keegan Randall is, but can you name her Alaska Pacific University coach? His name is Eric Flora. He's a workaholic who is enthusiastic, passionate, and motivated. And he deserves more than a little credit for the dramatic turnaround the U.S. cross-country ski team has managed in the last decade. APRN's Annie Feit has this profile.
It's a freezing cold morning at Hatcher Pass. The sun won't hit the cross-country ski course for at least another hour, and a steady wind is making things unpleasant. But as coach Eric Flora starts directing the morning's time trial, he appears to be enjoying himself.
All right, Andre. Ready, Andre, yeah? Nice.
Flora has reason to be in a good mood. When he became the director of Alaska Pacific University's Nordic program in 2006, he coached one young Olympian, Keegan Randall, and a handful of other promising athletes. Now, four of the 14 members of the U.S. cross-country Olympic team are from APU. In less than a decade, Flora has helped transform the idea of what's possible for U.S. cross-country skiing. The only American to win an Olympic medal in the sport was Bill Koch nearly 40 years ago. For Flora, it didn't add up.
We're Americans, you know, hardworking, lots of ingenuity. But for some reason in cross-country skiing, we just weren't doing it.
Flora had hoped to go to the Olympics himself, but a car accident at Hatcher Pass in 1999 left him with a career-ending back injury.
It was a pretty devastating experience. I'd worked my whole life towards this high-level skiing and Olympic goal. And then all of a sudden, it was taken away.
At first, Flora thought he was done with the sport for good. He took a job with an air taxi at Lake Hood to pursue his airplane mechanics license and become a pilot. For a few winters, Flora barely touched his skis. But then APU convinced him to teach master's athletes for about 6 hours a week. And that part-time job sparked a new passion for Flora, coaching.
It was amazing being able to pass along, you know, what I had learned, and to help someone forward, I could see that's what I wanted to do.
In 2002, Flora went to Salt Lake City to watch the Olympics. A friend from Norway, Tor Arne Hetland, was competing in the skate sprint that year. Flora met Hetland during a year he spent in Norway after high school, training with some of the country's best young skiers. In Salt Lake City, Hetland won gold. The moment was life-changing for Flora.
You know it's possible for someone to win a medal, but you've never seen it. You've never had breakfast with them. You know, they don't seem like they're human. Being friends first with this athlete, and then all of a sudden he wins a gold medal, and you're like, wait a second. I can do that.
Flora went skiing the next day and plotted his own comeback in the sport. When that plan fell apart, he turned his attention to taking his coaching to the next level. Keegan Randall was already a two-time Olympian and gaining ground on the World Cup. When Flora took over as her coach in 2006, he began boosting the amount she was training. A lot.
We didn't have a recipe book on how this works. We didn't have a manual over how to build this. But we kept on experimenting and trying to learn and find the key components.
A year later, in 2007, Randall won her first World Cup medal, a bronze in the skate sprint in Rybinsk, Russia. In the years since, she's steadily improved, racking up 10 World Cup golds. Flora also coached Holly Brooks' improbable transition from ski coach to Olympic-level athlete. Now siblings Sadie and Eric Bjornsson are heading to their first Olympics under Flora's direction. Luke Bodensteiner, a former teammate who's now vice president for athletics for the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Association, says Flora is getting results.
He really raised the bar. He, you know, has demanded a lot from his athletes. He's shown them not only how to, you know, do really big amounts of training, but how to do it wisely, how to put a premium on recovery.
Bodensteiner says even as Flora pushes his athletes hard, he's a remarkably easygoing guy who always has a positive attitude. That's how Holly Brooks sees it too, from her point of view as one of his skiers who also used to coach with him.
He just exudes passion. It's, you know, it could be raining sideways. We could be hypothermic, hungry, and he would still be jumping out of his socks excited. And so, you know, especially in a place like this where sometimes the training can get really hard, sometimes it can get monotonous, he's just an incredible motivator.
Flora says it turns out he's a far better coach than athlete. Now he's heading to Sochi with a team of medal contenders. And the formula is starting to look pretty simple to him.
I always felt like there had to be some kind of secret process that had to take place to have this international success that we're having. And it's funny, the more success we have, the easier it feels.
Looking back, Flora says the car accident at Hatcher Pass may have been one of the best things that ever happened to him. And in Sochi, he'll probably be the coach who looks like he's having the most fun on the side of the trail. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The top three Yukon Quest teams arrived in Eagle in the wee hours of Monday morning, well ahead of schedule. As KYC's Emily Schwing reports, it was clear as they relayed their stories that teams are starting to strategize as they near the halfway mark in this year's race.
Brent Sass was feeling pretty good about his run between Slavin's Roadhouse Dog Drop and Eagle.
And I got past that 60-mile mark, it was like they just got better. Better. And then, I mean, I went through that portage, and I was, they were trying to kill me. I mean, I was, like, on the brake. I mean, my biceps hurt from holding the bar up. This is 80 miles into the run, you know?
The Eureka Musher relayed his story to a group gathered in Eagle's old school. Sass says he knew he had to make a move to increase his lead over Hugh Neff and Alan Moore.
Because I don't have the speed that they have. So this was the right move for my dog team.
Sass planned to run the 105 miles in more or less a straight shot, but he didn't want to give away his plan. He let Neff and Moore go ahead, and he rode his brake for nearly 50 miles to a hospitality stop known as Trout Creek. That's when he switched off his headlamp. When he passed the cabin, he got off his sled and led his team through the fork in the trail. It's another 40 miles to the Eagle checkpoint.
And then I went quite a ways, and then I dropped my straw so that they'll get to go by that, too. So they'll know for sure that I went all the way.
Alan Moore left Slavin's behind Brent Sass, but caught him on the way to Trout Creek. Moore says he knew Sass would have to make a move.
If something doesn't go right, like he knew that I was faster than him, well, he has to do something different, or it's going to keep going the same.
As teams head for the Canadian border, Hugh Neff gives a warning.
Brent's got, 3 hours on us? I know that's nothing. I mean, so it's great for him, and it's impressive what he's doing with his long runs, but Dawson's where the action's going to heat up.
The first musher into Dawson claims 4 ounces of placer gold, but the top three mushers say that's not what they're racing for. On the Yukon Quest Trail in Eagle, I'm Emily Schwing.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Daisha Eaton and Shaylin Cochran in Anchorage, Tony Gorman in Valdez, and Emily Schwing on the Yukon Quest Trail. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Platt. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.gov. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation. The Alaska Sea Life Center will host the 5th annual Alaska Marine Gala on Saturday, February 15th at the Denina Center in Anchorage. The evening will include live and silent auctions, dinner, dancing, and a presentation by UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences Dean Dr. Mike Castellini. More information about sponsorship and tickets for this event can be found at alaskasealife.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Sea Life Center.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.